Hi, and thanks so much for joining me today. I'm Dr. Fred. You're listening to another episode of Study, Grow, Know, and this is our second installment of a short series called Prayer and Praise.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
Hi, as I mentioned at the top of this hour, you have tuned into Study, Grow, Know, and this is the second in a short series called Prayer and Praise. We're dealing with that subject, and we want to thank you for joining us. Now, in our first episode, first installment of this series, we introduced the concept of prayer, and we essentially said that we would eventually compare it with the concept of praise as well. We spoke briefly then about the meme or the saying, slogan that is on people's lips today within Christendom, and that slogan, that meme, is prayer is a powerful tool. But is it really a tool? Well, some obviously use it as though it was just that, a tool. And unfortunately, when you speak of tools, they become things that you can divorce from certain people. You can take a hammer. You can use my hammer. You can use it to build something, to take something apart, give it back to me when you're done. And I wonder if we don't do the same thing with prayer. We think of prayer as a tool that allows us to, I guess, become part of or log on to, if you will, the powers of the universe that will allow us to get what we want to get. But is that what prayer is to be used for? Is that really what it is? Well, some certainly use it like that. And if so, it seems that, as I mentioned, it might be relatively easy to just simply take prayer and divorce it from God. After all, it's just a tool, right? Is that the way people view prayer? Do you view prayer like that? Do you know other Christians who view prayer like that? Now, in our first installment, we broached the idea that prayer is really about conversing with God, not so much simply handing him our want list that he should get going on it as soon as possible or sooner. I also pointed out previously that Jesus should be our example in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night that he was betrayed, provides us with a very good example of exactly how we are to pray. The prayer that has become known as the Lord's Prayer is also an excellent example, and we'll get into that soon enough. Now, we ended our first installment by referencing James 4, verse 3, which tells us quite pointedly the following truth, quote, "You ask, and you do not receive, because you ask with wrong motives, so that you might spend it on your pleasures." Now, I'm going to quote here Dr. Constable, Thomas Constable, and he notes this about the book of James. He says, "The design of the epistle of James is on the one hand to encourage those to whom it is addressed to bear their trials patiently, and on the other hand, to warn them against certain errors of doctrine and practice." And that's something that as Christians we need to take more seriously. Certainly we need to guard ourselves against error in doctrine and practice. But I think a lot of times the error stems from the fact that we take things out of context as often as we do. These letters, when they were first written by James or by Paul or Peter or someone else, they didn't have reference marks. They didn't have verse 1, verse 2, verse 3. They didn't have chapter headings. They were basically sent as a continuous scroll. And they would be read before the entire congregation and were to be considered within the context of that particular scroll. But what we do today is we will take a verse here, a verse there, you know, everywhere a verse kind of thing, and then we memorize it, commit it to memory, and we think about it, and that becomes one of our favorite verses. And we often, in doing so, wind up forgetting the context that those verses came from. We tend to forget that there are certain forms of encouragement offered by writers of both the Old and New Testaments, as one for instance. Now, one type of encouragement helps Christians bear up under the stresses of life, including times of persecution. I think you would agree with me that once you become a Christian, problems don't end. In many ways, problems continue. And in some ways, they even get worse. They worsen because we have gone from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. And Satan doesn't like to let us off the hook that easily. So we often become a target. A target by the ungodly. The people who are still in Satan's kingdom. Sometimes we become targets of other Christians who are very immature or simply professing, not truly Christian at all. And so these books in the New Testament especially were written as a form of encouragement to help us bear up under those stresses of life, whatever those stresses happen to be. The other type of encouragement is designed to help Christians get on and stay on the correct theological or doctrinal path that is all too often easy to move away from for too many in society, especially today. And Paul warns us of this, and so does Peter, that in the last days, terrible times will come. People will be lovers of themselves, proud, boastful, and the list goes on. We know that as things ramp up toward the beginning of the coming tribulation, it's not going to be an easy road. But getting back to James, it is this second form of encouragement that James is using in the above verse, verse 4-3, where he tells his readers pointedly that they're asking amiss or from the wrong motives. But then they blame God for not receiving an answer that they were expecting or hoping for to their requests. And when we ask amiss or from the wrong motivation, we're indulging self. God not only has no obligation to give us what we want when we ask that in such a way, but he is actually doing us a tremendous favor by not responding to our selfish requests with a hearty, yes, I'll get right on that. Think of this question that each of us should ask ourselves. Am I asking for this thing because it benefits and brings glory to God and his kingdom, or am I asking out of selfish desire and ambition? If we were to really stop and ask ourselves that one question before we pray, I really think it would help us define the things in our life and the requests that we really need to ask God about. Now, most Christians, when they're sick or are in general poor health, maybe even having a disease that is generally known to lead to death, like cancer, those types of Christians will immediately ask God to remove the illness and heal them. We all do this. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it's often our first impulse. We don't want to be sick. We don't really want to have to face the prospect of death right now. But if we're honest with ourselves, we would have to admit that this is our first response simply because we don't want to suffer loss. That's the reality that we are living under. Why not go to the one who has the ability to heal? It would be ridiculous not to do that, we think. But having said that, let's go back to the Garden of Gethsemane to see how Jesus did it when he faced situations that he did not like. He also requested something based on the horror that he was facing at the time, and that's all we need to know. He was so appalled by what he faced that he asked the Father that this coming cup could be removed from him. And however, unlike most of us, he didn't stop there. Most of us simply ask and we beg and we continue to ask and we continue to beg. Jesus asked several times, but in each case, he added the caveat, yet not my will, but thine be done. These were not empty words. These were not just throwaway words that he tagged onto the end of his request, but they were ones that he not only knew he ought to add, but without adding them, he would have been dangerously close to sinning, really. To us, it smacks of defeat, though, doesn't it, when we apply those words to our own lives or that of a loved one. Someone's on their deathbed and we go, Lord, please heal them. And we don't want to say, if it be your will. We want him to do our will, because all we can think of right now is the loss that would engulf us should that person be taken from us. But we don't really know God's will, do we? We don't really know all that it entails and the ramifications of the decisions that he makes. But to us, it smacks of defeat when we ask, Lord, not mine, but yours be done. We often storm ahead like a bull in a china shop, making our requests known to God without even taking the time to try to understand what God actually is willing. What is his purpose in the matter before us? What's his will? Would you agree with me that we do this too often and too carelessly? Could it be that when we receive answers to our requests in the positive, we might become filled with pride as though it was due to our quote-unquote faith? Our faith got God to do that. Our faith moved God. See how strongly I'm able to believe in God that he was able to give me what I asked for? We put our faith in faith and not necessarily in God's will. Could that be? Is that a source of pride for many? I think it is. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about from my own personal life, and you can judge for yourself what you think of it. Several years ago, my sister, whom I loved very much, suffered a major heart attack that hospitalized her. She'd been in poor health for a while, and she was also overweight, which added to her problems. Yet she had continued enjoying life as best she could for the most part. Now, the day I received a phone call from her son-in-law stating that she'd had a heart attack and was in the hospital and I should make it, you know, back to see her because doctors did not feel she would recover. Well, when I received that phone call, I was in a bit of disbelief. It really didn't hit me. I was in California. She lived in Georgia. She wasn't an hour or so away by car. The whole thing just kind of seemed weird. Nothing was sinking in. But I did book a flight, and I couldn't leave until the next day. By the time I was able to get to her in the hospital, she had actually been in a coma for several days, and the doctors really held out no hope. No hope. But God was on my side, right? So I began praying, and more praying, and I contacted everyone I can think of. I even found people, get this, in the hospital who believed in healing prayer, and we prayed together. Strangers praying together. I did this for 2 or 3 days nonstop. I would wake up, and from the time I woke up to the time I fell asleep, I would be praising God for healing my sister, reminding him that I was praying in faith. But on the third or fourth day, I forget which one it was, upon waking up, I tried to pray, and I tried to believe my sister's healing was coming, and that she would wake up from her coma and be as good as new, but I couldn't do it. I could form words, but there was not a shred of faith to go with my words. They were just words. There was nothing behind them, and it was the strangest thing in the world, and something I have rarely experienced. It was as though God was saying, no, not today, where your sister is concerned. I'm not going to bring her back to life. I'm not going to wake her up out of the coma. She's not going to leave the hospital and go home. In fact, I didn't hear any voice at all. It was simply an impression, and I want to make that clear. God wasn't necessarily speaking to me audibly. It was an impression of what God might have said if he was saying anything. I had no ability at that point to believe that he was going to heal my sister. And I realized that God had no intention of healing my sister the way I wanted her healed. In fact, 4 days later, after I started, I came to the realization that this was the appointed time of her death, and there was nothing that was going to change that. Now, unlike Hezekiah, and we read about Hezekiah in Isaiah 38 and 2 Kings 20, this was the guy who, when he was told he was going to die and he needed to put his house in order, he cried and begged God to give him an extension of life. And God did. Unfortunately for Hezekiah and for the nation of Israel and for his immediate descendants, it would have been far better off had he just obeyed God, prepared his will, and died when God first said he was going to die. With that in mind, I knew I'd better stop asking. I conceded that God's will was better than mine because I did not know all things. I was not God. I was asking him to heal my sister, but I had no idea